Hi everyone, Dan Johnson, and you're listening to Radio Zine. My guest today is Paula Martinac, and Paula is the author of a book called Ada's Decades. And it's at this point where I think I need to tell you I have a confession. I am a fan of lesbian fiction, and of course, Paula is the author of a book on lesbian fiction, and she is joining us by phone in North Carolina. Now, my love for lesbian fiction began a long time ago with Rita Mae Brown, and of course, Rita is a cat fancier, but...
Oh, okay.
That's the only place where we separated water. She was a great water writer. When I received this fancy little work of fiction written by Paula, I decided right then and there that I needed to have her on Radio Zine. And so it is with great pleasure that I welcome her to the Pacific Northwest. And let's get started. Paula, tell us about Ada's Decades.
The book is called, it's called The Ada Decades, and it's a novel, but it's a little unusual in form. It's actually a novel in stories. And what that means is it's told in individual stories that then connect together and to form a novel, to form an arc for the characters. So each story, while it's contained in and of itself, the stories go together to form the complete story of a woman's life. And the reason I did that is because I actually started this book by writing one of the short stories that appear at the end of the book called Comfort Zone, where Ada is an older woman. She's 80 years old. And as I wrote about her, I got very interested in her and wanted to know more about her life. And so I decided to write this book from the perspective of Ada's life over the course of 7 decades, because I realized that she has seen a lot. She lives in the South. She had seen a lot in terms of change, in terms of racial integration of the schools. She'd seen a lot of change in terms of LGBT issues. So it seemed like a really good format to me to tell her story in these snapshots of different decades of her life. And the title just came from that because each chapter forms a decade in Ada's life.
Now, one of the unique ways this story opens up, you simply title it 1947, and Ada makes a life-changing discovery.
Yes, she's in 1947. She's little. She's about to turn 12. She's not really a tomboy, but she's not really very girly either. And she's helping her father she needs to get a tool from his toolbox for him. And she discovers that her father has held on to a photograph of a lynching of 3 black men in Salisbury, North Carolina. And so she makes this discovery, and it is life-changing for her, and she takes the photo in that first chapter to a woman named Miss Ruthie, who is the public librarian and is someone who has taken Ada under her wing, because she knows that Ada's a poor girl. Her father works at the cotton mill, and so Miss Ruthie has kind of taken her under her wing and is helping her and showing her pointing out different books that she could read. And so Ada naturally turns to Miss Ruthie to find out what this postcard is all about. And that sort of constitutes her first real awakening to the issues of race in the South. She hasn't really thought about it until that time, and she's going to have to think about it throughout her life because of her career and who she becomes.
Now, one of the unique things about this book is that I discovered it's only about 160 pages in length, which for a lot of fiction is really rather short. Were you tempted to make it longer?
I did think about that. I didn't I thought about when I thought about Aiden, as I said, I wrote about her first when she was 80 years old, and then I started going back in time to see how old she would have been at different moments in her life in different decades. And so I did consider what was it that I wanted to portray about her life. And, you know, I purposely sort of left some things out that I might have put in. There's nothing, for example, about her being in college. That's only shown in flashbacks. But what I really wanted to do was to indicate these very high points in her life, these points where something very important happened to her that sort of moved her forward. And to do that, I know it's not a very ponderous book in terms of its size, but it really covered for me the important things that I thought we needed to know about Ada. And brought her whole story and her whole arc to a logical conclusion.
Well, just between you and me and the 10,000 or so people that are listening to this show, I like that it is brief. It made me think of Shrunken White's Elements of Style, you know, and working in brevity. But like so many other stories, Ada's Decades takes place in the South, you know, Gone with the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird, and John Brent's Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which was really a chiller. What do you think it is about the South that makes it such fertile territory for building great narrative?
Well, that's a really good question, Dan. I think a lot of it has to do with the history of the South. It is a very violent history, and a lot of it has been, you know, we at the same time have this sort of romantic vision of the South too, and the, you know, the genteel planters and that sort of myth about the old South. But at the same time, it's a very violent history, and I think it just brings up a lot of emotions in people. I know it really struck me when I started living here. The landscape struck me. I live in an old mill community, which is the same one where Ada lives in the book. And the architecture, there was something different about the way everything looked, the way just the appearance of the place is so different. But then when I started going back in time and I realized Ada is a school librarian, and when I realized as going back in her life that she would have been starting her career at the same time that school integration began in the South and began very violently and very in this very disruptive way. You know, that was clear to me that was something that I had to write about, that had to be part of it. So, you know, this sort of violent history is something that really stuck with me and that I really wanted to portray in the book.
Do you think that the climate has improved over the decades in terms of equal rights for folks, no matter whether you're gay or black or what your, you know, thing in life may be? Have strides been made to improve life?
You know, certainly certain things have happened that have improved life for a lot of people. And but I think, you know, just speaking in terms of LGBT issues, we were talking about this briefly, but the political climate in North Carolina, where I live now, is horrible for LGBT people. And, you know, I think there's a lot of, I think the new administration in Washington and Congress, that this has sort of fed this sense that we might be going back in time a little bit, that we might be slipping and losing some ground as to the civil rights that we actually have obtained. I was just reading yesterday that there are some, you know, really right-wing conservatives in the North Carolina legislature who are trying to pass a bill that says, you know, we don't have to honor same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage doesn't apply here in North Carolina. So they want to defy the Supreme Court. So there are things like that happen, and I read that was sort of, they were trying, the right-wingers were trying North Carolina sort of as a test case for the rest of the South. And I think, you know, the southern states in particular are very vulnerable to things like that, to taking back rights, or, you know, we have a lot of issues around voting rights in the South that continue today and that have persisted through the decades. So, you know, you both make ground and then lose ground, and it's not really perhaps that you haven't gained as much ground as you really thought that you did.
Right, right. I need to take this break for just a moment. I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Radio Zine right here on KBOO FM. And Paula, just for your information, in 2018, coming up not all that far away, KBOO is going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary serving the Portland metropolitan area and a great part of the Pacific Northwest. It's just a great pleasure to be a part of that kind of institution that's been serving the needs of listeners for such a long time. Okay, here's a question that may sound like a softball, sophomoric kind of question, but when you're writing a story that involves multi-characters, how important has it been for you to find the right dialogue for both Ada and those that are joining her in this journey?
Oh, that's a good question. That's something that I teach fiction writing to students, so it's something that you have to think about a lot in terms of dialogue, not just being a conversation, but as something that displays character or that characterizes people. So sometimes you might have a little tick, a verbal tick that people do. And for example, the character Cam, who is Ada's lifetime partner, always calls her darling, and that's just her particular tick. She doesn't do it a lot, but whenever she uses a term of endearment for Ada, that's what she uses. Ada talks in a she's a little more formal. Her way of talking is a little more formal. She's a she's a working class woman. She was born into a working class family, and so I think sometimes she's a little more conscious of how she talks, and she's a little more conscious of wanting to say everything correctly. So I think that makes her a little more formal in her talk. So it's those kinds of particular things, peculiarities of speech that help to characterize and to set different characters apart from each other, so not everybody sounds alike. And you've probably read stories like that where everybody just sounds alike and everybody has the same sense of humor and quips, but you really need to distinguish people from each other by giving them these distinctive ways of saying things.
Now, you've got several male characters in the story, too, and they're involved in some of the dialogue structure. Was that a difficult thing for you to come up with, or did it seem just to flow naturally for you?
It flowed pretty naturally for me. I have always had, for many years, I've had a lot of gay male friends, and I was trying to imagine, and I've also read a lot of stories with gay male characters in them, and in terms of doing research for this book, I read oral histories of the way people in the South, LGBT people in the South, talked and got sort of their diction and words that they might have used and idioms and things like that. So it felt pretty natural to me once I figured out the difference between the two gay men are Augie and Twig, and they are lovers at one point, and then they break up and are friends. But they have, you know, they have their own tics, and they have their own way of speaking. And I've tried to make them distinctive from each other, and they're also distinctive from the women. But I think just in terms of my own experience, that felt pretty natural to me.
Okay. I've got to ask you this question, and it's going to be totally off track, so forgive me, because I don't want to forget to ask you. And that is, have you ever been to the Pacific Northwest?
I have never been to the Pacific Northwest, and that's a horrible thing to admit, but I really would like to go.
Well, my friend, put it on your schedule. because I think that you would find it a very rich and wonderful part of the country to be in. And, you know, some folks, like me, came here and never went back. So, you know, I just say that because we've got a lot of great bookstores in Portland, too. So,
I would love to.
Okay, back to work here.
Okay,
what has your experience taught you about character building? And I know we've talked about the character structure a little bit. And how important is that in telling a good story?
Oh, it's really important. I mean, I had to, as I described, I saw her first as an 80-year-old woman toward the end of the book, and that was the first story that I wrote. And I didn't really know very much about her. But she's sort of, I think of characters as revealing themselves to you as you go along and as you're writing. And she really did reveal herself to me over time. I knew pretty early on that she had, you know, a very distinctive moral code, sort of a moral compass. I wasn't quite sure where that would lead her, but I knew that her moral compass would be constantly challenged by having to make decisions that might test her own moral compass. And I was very conscious of her wanting to be, I wanted her to be religious, because I know that has been such an important part of LGBT people's lives that we don't really look at very much, or that, you know, people from the outside or the religious right who tries to take rights away from LGBT people or, you know, don't really think of us as being religious people, but many, many people are people of faith. And in particular in the South, you know, where maybe one of the early things that people ask you when you move to the South is what church are you going to go to? So it's a very big part of life here. And so I wanted that to be part of Ada's life, and to have it be something that, again, would challenge her, that she would be challenged by the fact that religion is not always the comfort that she might want it to be, or that a lot of people might find it to be, that for LGBT people it's more complicated than that. So I mean, it was very important for me to find out these specific things about Ada as I was going along, and to know how she would react in certain circumstances, and to see her sometimes being weak and sometimes making the wrong choice, and that I think that's okay, that she would turn around. People, readers might get angry at her at times, but she, you know, eventually will find that moral code again for herself.
Do you think Ada was surprised to learn that she was a lesbian?
I do think she was surprised. I think she has always, when she was young and in college, I tried to show that she's been drawn to women. She's been drawn to women friends. She was drawn to Miss Ruthie, the librarian, and she was drawn to her friend Natalie in college. So she knows about having strong female relationships. I think what surprises her is that it could be more. Like, she hadn't really considered that until she met Cam, and she realized she knew that she sort of wanted something more with her college friend Natalie, but she didn't really know what that was. She was a very naive young woman, and so it hadn't occurred to her. But once it occurred to her that she could have this life. She's not interested in men. She, has these strong female connections. And so once she realized that was possible, that seemed like an easy choice for her to make, to accept that life and to accept herself as a lesbian.
Well, when the story comes to its conclusion, there is nothing there that I saw that she, over those decades, had any regrets for the decisions that she'd made.
No, I think that's true. I didn't want her to have any regrets about the big choices in her life. I think she is always very firm, even though she and Cam have a lot of obstacles that they face. And one of them that comes out in the book, and it's not too much of a spoiler, but Cam does have a drinking problem that is shown throughout the book. And, you know, coming to terms with that, even though she has to face that, you know, Ada is willing to do that because it's a strong relationship, and they have a very strong worldview and a very strong connection. And so I don't think she ever regrets, for example, that relationship or the decisions that she had to make in terms of, taking care of her father, for example, or any of the things that arise, any of the problems that arise for her over the decades.
Right, right. And especially considering that first school that she was a librarian at, and everybody was deeply conservative and certainly showed strong biases, there was no indication there that, aside from just meeting Cam for the first time, that they would end up in any kind of a relationship.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, that's sort of the mystery of Gaydar, right? How people find each other. This is something that's been of interest to me for a long time, how women in the past found each other, under these conditions where you couldn't, there may have been gay bars, but if you were, if you didn't identify as gay, how did you come to meet someone who became your life partner? And I've discovered more in my reading that a lot of women met each other through common interests. For example, if they were working in schools or they were working in Phyllis Lyons and Del Martin met when they worked at the same publishing company, for example. So people who shared your interest and you could eventually form a life with and a commitment to, that there are all sorts of unique ways that people found each other when they didn't have the benefits of things like gay pride marches and community centers and all the wonderful stuff that we have today.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. We've had a few minutes to get to know you and find out a little bit more about Ada and Cam. If you look at yourself in retrospection, I think I just invented a new word. Are you, as a writer, as a person, more like Ada, or would you be more like Cam?
It's a really good question, and I think I'm actually kind of both of them. I've drawn on myself for both of those characters, and writers do this. You draw on your own experience for all of your characters, and I certainly did that with these two main characters. I think, in terms of the being an introvert is more where I fall on the spectrum, so that's more like Ada. Cam is much more of an extrovert. But in terms of being more vocal about, for example, about civil rights and going to marches and the kinds of things that Cam does, those are things that I identify more strongly with. I wouldn't sit out the March on Washington in 1963 the way she does. So I think that I've drawn from both of them, in terms of, and I think that's true of people in life too, that sometimes you go back and forth. And I wanted to show that sometimes Ada is the stronger person and sometimes Cam is the stronger one in the relationship. And, that it's not all one way or the other, that one person is always, coming out on top, that it's a back and forth over the course of all the years that they're together.
It seems to me that that's really true. I can't help but agree with you. I mean, there has to be an equal balance in any kind of a relationship, and no matter how strenuous or challenging they may be.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, now, I omitted in the introduction the fact that you were a Lambda winner. That was a long time ago. Do you have something new coming out now that this one is finished?
I have another book that I'm just finishing up, but I'm just finishing the first draft, so, and it's kind of messy, so it's going to be a while. It's a new novel. It's right now it's called Cleo Rising, and it's about a young lesbian who, it takes place in 1983 in New York City, and she's a young woman who is an assistant to a famous female writer who was part of the Paris generation, the lost generation in Paris in the 20s and 30s. So it's a different kind of book, but as I said, it's kind of messy, so I'm not quite sure when that one's going to be out. But that one, that's my next project up.
Right. Well, you know, as the school year winds down, perhaps you can talk the publisher into sending you on a book tour and get you out here into the Pacific Northwest, where there's going to be a strong market for books like that.
Yeah. Oh, I would love that. Yes,
yeah.
I'd love to visit Portland.
Yeah. Just as we're starting to wind down here now, I'm trying to think of the way I want to phrase this. How impactful is lesbian fiction, gay fiction, on the marketplace today? Is there a market for it?
Well, it's changed over time, and as you pointed out, I've been publishing for a number of years. My first novel came out in 1990 with Seal Press, which was actually in Seattle. So that was a wonderful press. And in the past, in the 90s in particular, there were a lot more options for publishing with small presses. There are fewer today, and I think there's, even though the LGBT movement has made a lot of strides, I think there's still some compartmentalizing of us, that I'm not sure that our stories are always seen as universal in the mainstream, particularly lesbians who may be a little bit more marginalized than gay men. I'm not quite sure about that. I haven't really analyzed the market that well, but there is this sense that, you know, maybe our stories aren't quite seen as applying to everyone. And I've had some, you know, straight readers who have read this book and have been surprised that they actually could connect with Ada and Cam, and that's because there are universals. You know, love is a universal thing.
Sure.
You know, relationships are universal, and relationships over time are something that we don't see very much in literature anyway, and that I wanted to portray that, and mine, you know, it happens to be a relationship between two women, which, you know, they face particular obstacles, but some things are universal in terms of relationships and the obstacles that people face over time.
Well, it's been absolutely delightful to spend time with you. I wish you the very best. I enjoyed reading the book. I think that if folks are interested, they're going to find a way to pick your book up, and by all means try to visit us out here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically Portland. And
yes,
to our listeners, you've been listening to Radio Zine. I'm Dan Johnson. My guest has been Paula Martinac, author of Ada's Decades. And to our listeners and to Paula, I say thank you all very much for joining us today on Radio Zine. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.